Hey, I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee. We have Representative Hornstein. Looks like you're probably engaged discussing the minutes there.
Yes, we were really pleased with them and wanted to move the April 26th.
So would one of you like to make a motion?
Yeah, we'll both. I mean, this is a joint
Mariani-Hornstein. Representative Hornstein, you have
I will move those meeting the minutes
okay,
from
Representative
April
Hornstein
26th.
Moves approval of the minutes for the April 26th meeting. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. We have several bills up this morning, and the first one on the agenda is House File 92 by Representative Winkler. I think I saw him come in. Yeah, there we go. Representative Winkler, if you would like to walk us through the bill, and the chair moves that House File number 92 be recommended pass and re-referred to the General Registry. And then we have an amendment. Would you like the amendment to be adopted before you present the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Put it in the order that you would like?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so the chair moves that the H00928(12) amendment
Mr. Chair.
Be adopted. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, just I'll restate my view of putting bills in the way author wants, and that's appropriate for the first committee. It's not appropriate for a subsequent committee. This is a very substantive amendment. Could we please have it described before we just throw it on?
I didn't hear the last part of your comment, Representative Abler.
Well, I think we should have it described at least before we put it on.
Well, that's my intent. I moved the amendment, and
okay,
I was
going to
call for discussion.
All right, thanks.
But it is the way the author would like to have it, and Representative Abler, that's the procedure that we have used throughout the session, calling for discussion. So,
and
Representative Olberg?
Mr. Chair, I think there might be people in the audience that also want to speak to this amendment.
Okay, and as we always do, if there's a specific question of somebody in the audience, that will be addressed. But the first step is to let the author explain the amendment, and then we'll ask for further discussion. So, Representative Winkler, on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the A-12 amendment does a few things. If you look at lines 2.30 and 2.31, it changes the threshold definition from small employer and large employer under state law from $625,000 to $500,000. And that is to bring that number in line with the federal dividing line. The federal minimum wage separates companies at a $500,000 number. If you look at lines 2.32 to lines 3.3, we are reducing the minimum wage standards that were in House File 92 as it moved out of the last committee into this committee. So we are reducing the hourly rate. Lines 3.6 through 3.20 are also a federal conformity piece. Representative Metza has advanced a bill to align Minnesota labor and hour standards with federal law. Federal law, as you know, requires that overtime be paid after 40 hours of work. And in Minnesota, that number is 48 hours. So this brings Minnesota state law in compliance with federal law, and it is, I believe it's House File 362 that Representative Metza has been carrying. Similarly, in lines 3.21 and through 3.25, we're changing it from 48 to 40 to be consistent with federal law. Section 5, lines 3.27 to 4.10 is another provision for Representative Metz's bill, which is parental leave and moving the state law standard to the federal law standard of 12 hours. So those sections of the amendment do two things, really. They make clear that overtime starts at 40 hours in Minnesota, as was carried in Representative Metz's bill, It goes from 6 weeks to 12 weeks for paid leave in for parental leave, which is consistent with federal law. It goes from the $625,000 threshold to a $500,000 threshold, which is consistent with federal law. And finally, it reduces the minimum wage rates that were previously in House File 92.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Oh, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, on the unpaid parental leave and bringing that consistent with federal law, does that mean any really change for Minnesota employers? Because that has been federal law for some point. Are there certain employers in Minnesota that would now be subject to this leave requirement that currently are not? And that's Section 5 of the amendment, 3.27 to 3.31.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I believe that that changes the base for smaller companies. The federal law of the Family Medical Leave Act applies, I think, to companies with 50 or more employees, and this would cover smaller companies.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler. Do you know then what size company, what would be the smallest size company that would now be subject to this requirement?
And Representative Loon, this is Representative Metz's provision. I actually have to pull the statute book to confirm that number, but I certainly could do that for you if you'd like.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbert.
Well, Mr. Chair, I want, you know, once again, we're doing major policy in ways and means, and I'm just curious, Representative Winkler, do you know why this bill wasn't moved separately or why this wasn't done in the Jobs Committee?
Representative
Winkler. Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I would direct that question to Representative Mahoney, who is the chair of that committee.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook. Representative Metz's bill had a full hearing in the Jobs Committee, and we went over the parental leave, the under $500,000 for a small company. It affects very few, and the whole thing. And Representative Winkler's bill, as it came through the committee, only addressed wages. And at that particular time, there was still a conversation going on. And this is the last stop to put this bill in federal conformity, which I think will make it much simpler for almost all Minnesota companies to comply with the minimum wage. One of the things that I found interesting, both from industry and from the Department of Labor and Industry, is most of their enforcement actions are not people willfully violating minimum wage, but because Minnesota and the federal government were both different, there were a lot of inadvertent mistakes made on the whole issue. So putting this into federal compliance will make it much simpler and much less expensive for companies to comply and for the state I'm trying to think of the word and I'm having one of those. Comply. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, is it true that there was quite a bit of concern expressed about the going from the 48 to 40, especially with the agriculture community?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I'm off the top of my head, I'm going to do this. So, although I will quote a member in the committee who essentially said, you know, if they don't like paying overtime, why don't they just make them salaried? Which would, I believe it is 380 something to 470 something a week, or $470 a week to $380 a week, exempts them from the overtime rules. So they could just put them on salary, and it'd be a done deal, and they wouldn't have to worry about it.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney, and Chair Carlson, I would hope that you'd be willing to ask if there's anybody in the audience that would like to speak to this amendment.
Representative Holberg, as I mentioned earlier, if a committee member has a question, we'll be happy to entertain that. So do you have a question of somebody from the audience or some group that you'd like to hear from?
Well, Mr. Chair, I understand that there's members of the chamber here, but I wasn't contacted directly by members of the agriculture lobbying community, but concerns were at least relayed to me from that group as well. And so if either of those two groups...
Is there anybody from the agriculture community present that would like to come in? Apparently not. You mentioned the chambers. Is there anybody from the chamber that would like to comment? Yeah, somebody's coming forward. Okay.
It's nice to...
Good morning.
Okay, and on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We do have some concerns about this bill. We've gone through the process, and I'd like to thank Representative Winkler. I mean, he did reduce the original amount, but we still have significant concerns. Through the various committee hearings, we've addressed some of the specific issues related to the fact that Minnesota, with its surroundings, has the highest teen unemployment rate outside of Wisconsin. Considering the surrounding states, it's significantly higher compared to North Dakota and South Dakota. One of the things that we've reiterated in multiple hearings is that when we went around the state with Minsky and talked to businesses, one of the things that we heard most often repeatedly is that that when people graduate from college or trade school, they may have the technical skills or the hard skills that they need for the jobs, but they're lacking those soft skills, and those are things you can't teach in a classroom setting. And a lot of those and I know from my own personal example, I've worked a minimum wage job before, and that's where you learn to interact with other employees, you learn to interact with your boss, and it's concerning for us when you see these dramatic increases that a lot of those lower skilled younger workers are going to be cut out of the workforce too early. And we have other members of the business community here that have shared similar concerns as well about the impact on their specific businesses, whether it's due to the increases putting off significant investments back into their business, which also creates jobs and spurs innovation within their own business. I think one thing that I heard in Chair Mahoney's committee, small town people should pay small town people more money, but nothing in current law prevents people from paying their workers more. And so, the example of Costco is brought up repeatedly. Well, Costco has a different business model than a lot of other small town retailers across the state. So we have to be cognizant of that when we're especially proposing such drastic increases in the wage.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, can you tell us what percentage of the Minnesota businesses would be affected by this change of the 6 to 12 weeks of leave and the 40 to 48 hours that are not currently held to federal standards?
Mr. Gerber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, you're specifically addressing the agricultural exemption. I was speaking with somebody earlier, and I haven't... had the opportunity to work on a farm, but when you are milking cows, you don't control when they're producing milk or not, and so that exemption is specifically important to that industry. The way I understand it is our surrounding states we're one of the largest milk producing states, Wisconsin and Iowa also as well, that they have their laws constructed similar to ours now, so changing it would put some of those industries at a large competitive disadvantage.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler,
the provisions contained in Representative Metzger was an initiative from the Department of Labor and Industry. I think somebody's here if there were more technical questions that the committee members would like to have answered.
Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm curious as to what percent of our businesses that aren't required to meet these standards would now have different standards of employment imposed on them in just a matter of a few months without being able to, you know, plan for that in their budgeting, et cetera. So,
okay, would you like to hear from Labor and Industry or
a Dolly person? And I guess Mr. Rockler also wanted to testify.
Mr. Who?
Rockler, Ken Rockler. I think he contacted committee staff as well.
Yeah, he's on our list.
I'm just wondering if the guy from Dolly is getting coached.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Chairman Carlson, members of the committee, my name is Ken Rockler, and I'm here representing the Tavern League and the bowling proprietors. And I was in the restaurant business for close to 30 years on my own. I realize that it's too late for an amendment, and I'm here just, this is the last stop, I guess, where I can express my concern and those of my members and, quite frankly, the entire hospitality industry. I've heard a lot of talk about federal conformity. The major thing the hospitality industry needs in terms of federal conformity is we need a two-tiered wage. We're not asking for federal conformity, by the way. There was a bill that was in that Representative Gunther had. I don't believe it ended up getting a hearing, but it was introduced. I think it was House File 1225. What it really said was this, and that's that compared to the federal conformity, which allows a two-tiered wage at $2.13 an hour, as long as tipped employees are making at least the federal minimum of $7.25, Representative Gunther's bill said what we wanted to do was freeze our wage right now at $7.25, but only in those cases where tipped employees made at least $12 per hour during a pay period. I think the misconception is that this is a situation that's good for the server. I wouldn't doubt that there are a few cases where it'll be good for the server. I've had this discussion with many of you here on the committee before, but I think overall what's going on right now is that business is being driven from those places where the servers earn the most, full-service restaurants, right, to places like Panera Bread, Chipotle, even Caribou Coffee for that matter. I've talked to a number of you that have been to Panera Bread lately. You are not allowed to tip there. They do not allow tipping there. If you go to Caribou Coffee, you cannot put a tip on the credit card. The reason why this is going on is these corporations have recognized right now how important price point is. So I guess at this point I would, I guess you can't consider it right now. It's too late for an amendment, but I am expressing the concern that this is going to go forward, and pretty good at guessing these numbers because I've been in the business for a long, long time. I would say if we're back here again next year, you'll see that there'll have been a loss somewhere in the area of 15,000 to 20,000 jobs. Maybe not by then. It depends when it goes into effect. Your minimum wage will go into effect by August 1. The last thing on that is some of you said, well, what do you mean? People are going to just shut down? No. There's a long distance between status quo of where we were a couple of years ago and shutting down. There are full-service restaurants right now that don't serve lunch anymore, or if they do, they're only doing it in half of the building, or they put a manager into a bartender's job. But more importantly, restaurants like Famous Dave's, recognizing the costs that are coming right now, are going to fast casual. So again, I don't know if anybody has any questions of me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today.
Yeah. We have quite a long list of members that have questions generally before the testifier. Was Representative Simon was here as of the testifier?
Yes, it was.
Okay, Mr. Rockler, if there was a question of you, Representative Simon.
Thank you. Mr. Rockler, I have a question for you. It's kind of a historical question since you've been involved for a while, and since you're at least first, maybe the only testifier on this, I certainly don't mean to pick on you, but my question to you and others who oppose this is this. It has to do with 2005. It was my first year as a legislator and the last time we raised the minimum wage. And then, as now, there were a lot of predictions about what would happen of the kind that you just made. Could you tell us, or do you remember, what your predictions were in 2005 about what would happen if we raised the minimum wage?
And did they come true? Because I and other legislators have heard these predictions for a long time, and I'd be very interested to know whether the horror stories actually came true. I'm betting not, but I'd like to hear it from you.
Well, first of all, I didn't make any predictions in 2005. It was a little bit different right now, because now we're talking about going up to a level of $9, $10. I'm not exactly sure where the bill is going right now. So I guess I can't comment on predictions that were made. I can tell you what has happened since then without, I won't name any restaurants, but in the chairman's district, for example, the restaurant that was the busiest single restaurant in the New Hope area now only serves a short menu in their bar side compared to what they did then. They used to do 400 lunches. I'm guessing they don't even do 150 at this point. Is all of that because of the tip credit, by the way? No. No, there wasn't the broad-based fast casual business. At least it wasn't as big as it is right now. I'm just pretty comfortable about the fact that if any of you have been to the local restaurants around here and you've had a bacon cheeseburger lately, I know I've talked to a number of you about this. I actually carry an invoice on me. I had the opportunity to show it to Representative Winkler the other day. If we both went there, Chairman Carlson, Representative Simon, there's a local restaurant just right around here, and nobody would probably been there all the time. Each have a bacon cheeseburger. Don't order a salad or soup. We don't have an appetizer, no dessert, no alcoholic beverage, and we each have an iced tea, let's say, or a Diet Coke. Our bill comes to $34, and with a 20% tip, you're at $40.80. Now, a number of you might be able to afford that. Quite frankly, I can afford that. Basically, I live for free with my girlfriend at this point. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to. But you can't tell me that you don't recognize that there isn't a price point that drives people to Wendy's or McDonald's or Chipotle or Panera Bread. And those are all fine organizations, but the people there earn a lot less. I guess as long as we're on that point, there might be just as many employees, but my granddaughter's coming here this summer, so I asked at Panera Bread if there was any openings. And they said, yeah. Remember, they're not allowed to accept tips. So they start people at 8-10 is what I was told there, and the people that have been there for 9 months are now up to $8.60. So what are we accomplishing when we're driving people from places where they're averaging anywhere up to $30 an hour? I'm not saying that's the state average, but most of the metro places are up there well above $22 or $23. We're literally driving people from full-service restaurants to fast casual. So the very people that you think that you're helping right now, you're actually, I would estimate in 90% of the cases, you're hindering. I guess I'm editorializing a little on the opening, but the one last thing I would point out, this very body of the House, not the Ways and Means Committee, just recently cut $150 million out of the Health and Human Services budget. You didn't do it because you wanted to cut $150 million out. You did it because there's only so much price elasticity, which in your case is taxes, that you can do, and something had to give. Where these raises really are harmful right now is to the back of the house. That's where it's really affecting. This raise right now that you're proposing, I don't have a single member, at least in the metropolitan area, that every one of their kitchen and dishwashers and prep and cooks, that type of thing, every single one of them is far above the minimum wage. You're simply giving a raise right now to the servers, which is actually the highest paid segment of the population.
Okay, we have Representative Poppy. Representative Poppy, you had a question of the department, and they were ready to come down.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to figure out what percent or number of employers will now be held to these different standards as a result of this.
Yeah, I didn't mean to jump ahead of you. Representative Poppy, we'll get to you next, but if the department has an answer to Representative Holbert's question.
Mr. Chairman, John Rakuski with the Department of Labor and Industry. The three elements that Representative Winkler is amending from the Representative Metz's bill as an agency proposal, as Representative Mahoney said, the department's attempting in these statutory changes to make the statute less complicated to both employers and employees. And as to how many employers will be affected, I'll touch on the overtime. Minnesota has the highest overtime requirement at 48 hours of any state in the union. 31 states, just for your information, have the 40-hour requirement, which is the federal conformity. We have about, give you a few numbers here, I'll be brief. We have a little over 3 million compensated employees in this state, knowing that many people, homemakers, for example, I like to point out, aren't compensated with money, but they're compensated in other ways. But we have about 3 million workers who are compensated in this state. About half of those are hourly workers, all of whom are currently eligible for overtime after 48 hours. Only a portion of them are eligible for overtime after 40 hours. Who are these people? They're farm workers, home health care workers, and workers in establishments grossing less than $500,000 and not otherwise engaged in interstate commerce. We were asked before the session started from the governor's office to try to figure out how many people would be affected by the change from 48 to 40, and working in consultation with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, of those 1.5 million workers, we estimate about 80 to 120,000 of those workers are subject to the 48-hour rule. And of those, we still do not have a hard count of home health care workers, but we estimate it to be from the Department of Health and Human Services. And again, these are all estimates because they base these reporting requirements on two-week payroll records for the purposes of collecting unemployment insurance. So it's constantly changing. So these are estimates, and you can do with consider that as you make your decision. Of the 80 to 120,000 folks who have to work the 49th hour before they get overtime, approximately 20,000, we estimate, are engaged in the livestock-producing business, and about 7 to 10,000 are in the home health care business. And regarding the parental leave, you asked about that, Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to get a feel for what percent of the number of businesses that currently are not held to the federal standard that now, because of this change in law, will have different standards for leave and overtime.
Representative Carlson and Representative Holberg, I understand you're looking for, we don't track number of employers. Our job at Labor and Industry is to keep track of wage and hour for employees. So that's why I'm giving you statistics of employees.
Well, Mr. Chair, is it true that all employees and all employers that have more than 50 employees currently are held to the federal standards?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, that's true for the parental leave law, correct, the family medical leave
and
law.
Mr. Chair, is that true for the 48-hour or the 40-hour versus 48-hour for overtime?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, no, it's based on the annual sales tax revenue of $50,000 or more is when the federal conformity kicks in for overtime and minimum wage.
Mr. Chair, and do you have any type of total number of employers in the state of Minnesota and any kind of matrix as far as numbers of employees, any kind of range or breakout that way? Would we be able to know how many employers in the state of Minnesota have 50 or less employees currently?
Mr. Rakowski.
Representative Carlson, Representative Holberg, perhaps the chamber might have that or the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I don't have that information. I'm sorry.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Before you leave, I think on this point, Representative Anderson had a question.
I'll pass.
Okay. Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe first for the testifier, you said that 31 states have the 40 hours. Of those 31 states, how many affect the ag workers?
Do you have that?
Representative Hoppe, I do not know that there's an individual here from the ag community. There's nobody here from the Department of Ag. I do know that Wisconsin and Iowa, we've had this discussion during the session about livestock producers. Wisconsin and Iowa adhere to the federal exemption where there's no overtime requirement. And I think many of you recall that the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed during the Roosevelt administration 75 years ago, and there were a whole lot more folks working on the farm than today.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, I certainly have spoken with Representative Winkler about this and Representative Metza, that I too have heard from many of the ag employers and animal ag, and they're concerned about the change. I think that Minnesota has had a law that has allowed for the 48 hours, and we are an outlier even with that, because Minnesota is different from Iowa and Wisconsin, which are neighboring states for us, obviously. And I think we've identified that there is a need to provide that balance to protect the ag employees at the 48 hours so that they do get some overtime, but also it does allow for the ag employers to manage their employees during those peak times. And I think that's important to recognize. This is not, the ag workers are not necessarily like factory workers where they can go in and clock out. Certainly agriculture has a concern about weather conditions and about other natural occurrences, and they're not as easy to just say this is when we're going to do something and get it done. They have to worry about what the weather is, whether or not there's extra rain or there's extra drought or whatever might be happening. And so although I can understand the uniformity argument, when you're talking about uniformity with regards to agriculture workers, you really should be looking at the outlying states, and certainly it can't just be something that's done within Minnesota. I think we have to be looking at our neighboring states, and I certainly do not support changing this from the 48 hours to 40 hours, and I think there are plenty in the ag area that either animal ag or even crop farmers who during peak times, either planting or harvest, they need to rely on those workers, and there are many that probably do pay overtime at 40 hours because they understand it's important to have good and loyal employees, but to require it at that rate is just a step too far, and I do not support this change. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I didn't mean to be so nervous in the beginning. I appreciate your intention to have a good dialogue about this, and so thank you for that.
Representative Abler, as I pointed out, I've never adopted an amendment without calling for discussion. There was once a week or so ago where nobody responded. I think they were sleeping at the switch, but discussion was called for. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just want to make sure that people understand that. Representative Abler.
Yeah, well, thanks. In some committees, they just do that, and it's like, I just never thought that was reasonable. But so thanks for that. I'm not going to discuss process. If you think, if you like sausage or appreciate the law, you shouldn't watch either being made, so we're doing that. But I just want to talk about the content here, and I was surprised, frankly, to read the amendment. I actually looked at our amendments on the weekend preparing for today, and here's this big amendment that takes the minimum wage bill to a kind of a workplace reform bill. To make it tough on small business. If you remember, I voted for the minimum wage, whatever year that was, 2005 or whatever. I thought it was reasonable. I was trying to find a way I could go to vote for a minimum wage bill this year, like what would be a reasonable number and how do you carve people out and avoid harm to the small business. And so I wasn't even going to talk, but I was reading this new amendment, and I just wanted to point out, as a guy who's a small business who happens to be in that bubble, I'm not affected by the wages. Nobody can work in the metro for those prices anyway. In my clinic, it's I'm not sure what good the bill even does in the metro for workers in clinical niches, et cetera. I think the problem in the outstate is that the people that worked for quite a while to get a little bit above that threshold now are going to be challenged by a Walmart who's going to have to hire at that wage, and then actually undermine the long-term care industry, which is going to be an unintended consequence, which you need to pay attention to, sort of along the ilk of what Representative Poppy was talking about with the ag side. And so in the long-term care side, there is no more pot of money to go to pay these people. And just to tell you that, so I just want to caution you about what you're doing there. But on the 12-week leave and the overtime, I have a number of part-timers that have a couple jobs that work for me. One, their boss announced last week to them that there's no hour, they're not working 1 minute past 40 hours based upon the new law that's coming to them, because they're not going to pay that kind of money. And those staffers work in the low 40s, but they're going to cut it off at clearly at 40.0, 39.999. They're going to have to punch out and stop working, which will solve any benefit you're hoping to get to the people on the small amount of overtime bits. But also what happens to that employer now is they don't have the flexibility to handle workload changes. And if you think that's not a big deal, I think in my, I don't know how many FTAs I have, maybe six or something like that, but we have like 10 different employees that fill in, and one person gets close to 40. But they're very happy with their hours, and it works out pretty well. And we have some great long-term employees. But in a small business, you don't have a lot of slack. If one person goes on vacation, they all have to work a little extra to fill in. And it's, they all get tired by the end, and they're happy when they show up again. This 6 week to 12 week leave is not a petty matter for a clinic like ours or a small business. It isn't like you just have somebody who can go fill in. It's a huge gap. And so I want to caution you, what you're going to provoke here is people even decide if they're going to hire women of childbearing age or not. Or people who are going to just, oh, we're starting a family. Oh, really? That's interesting. Well, thanks for stopping by. Because there isn't 12 weeks of capacity in my clinic to handle somebody being gone. If they were sick, we would try to accommodate them. We're we try to be kind to our employees, but I'm cautioning you, this is not a minor thing at all. And because it just isn't the slack. And if you hire somebody temporary, they don't know anything about the business. Our work is very complicated with all the healthcare changes and record keeping and all. And so it isn't, you can just plug somebody in. And so I wanted to just caution you. This makes it even harder for me to go along with this bill. I appreciate the effort you made in lowering the numbers to get to be more realistic. I do hope you listen to Mr. Rockler and others. What seems like a good idea may not be a good idea. And in the name of helping labor, you might labor in the lower end, you may actually be causing some harm. And I don't say that politically, you know, my position on these labor matters. I actually really appreciate when labor and business work together. It seems like that marriage isn't working in this project, and I don't know what the conference plan for this is. Obviously, you're putting a lot of stuff here now, which is surprising to many people who didn't read the amendment over the weekend. There might be more in the audience if they would have known these were being married here. But I do hope as this goes forward, when you get to conference times, that the Senate's different, that you sit down with the people in the audience who didn't testify or those who don't know to come, with the labor people and the business people. The best labor and business is when they work together and understand labor needs business, business needs labor. And look out for the unintended consequences. And talk to the small business people who are going to be affected by this. You will learn a lot. You'll have a better bill. Already in small business, where some of them are affected by the ACA tax and the need to provide health care, those on the bubble for the size. And it's challenging. And we talked about the subchapter S flow-throughs, 3.3%, and is it more than that or not, and all these taxes. There is no capacity in Main Street to absorb any more expense. I rent to them in my other two-day jobs. And they're barely hanging on now. And when the retail side drops off, these people can't pay their rent, they go out of business, they go out of vacancy. And so I'm just cautioning you to be aware of what good thing you want to do. It's a high-minded, good intent, and a nice thing. Just beware. The budget that we passed has plans on a $2.1 billion increase in 16 and 17 on the revenue side to support all the things that you've chosen to buy plus your tax increases. If that drops to $1.5 billion, you're in deficit again. That's only a 25% change on the margin, not on the whole bottom business, but on the margin. So these sort of things make it hard for the margin to occur. So I just caution you, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
And by the way, this amendment was posted last Thursday, 4/25 at 10:53. So it's been out there for several days. Representative Dittmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this could be either for the testifier or the author. You know, I think a lot of us probably gotten letters from the grocery stores, the retail grocers. And I know a lot of their employees, the one out of every three of those employees that are told me was that they're either ages 16 to 24. So a lot of them are high school students, college students, earning extra money for college. And does this bill create a business model that would mandate raises every year because of the increase in inflation? And will this not allow the will this allow increases based on merit and work ethic? I mean, does this that's just a question that I have for the author.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, the bill does contain an inflationary adjustment to the minimum wage going forward, starting in 2016. And I would argue that that is actually a better environment for business rather than waiting to see whether the legislature takes action. The history of the minimum wage has been that we have raised it, and then we have done nothing for a period of 5 to 10 years, and then jack it up again very quickly, and then do nothing for 5 to 10 years. And it's never really clear to a business when they're going to be hit with a minimum wage increase or not. It really is dependent on the political environment in St. Paul. By creating a inflationary adjustment, we're actually giving businesses a much more predictable, smooth path on the minimum wage than what they have had in, under our political decision-making process over the last several decades. So, yes, it has an inflationary adjustment, but I would suggest that that is a more predictable adjustment than what you've seen in the legislative process.
Mr. Chair, and then would this apply only to full-time workers? What about the part-time that works 10, 15, 20 hours a week? Does this just apply to full-time workers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, the bill does not distinguish between full and part-time. It does contain a training wage for the first 90 days of employment, however, at a lower rate than either the large or small employer percentage, and that is something that's been in Minnesota law already, and we are only adjusting the dollar amounts.
Mr. Chair, just a comment then. I think a lot of the retail food industry has had some real concerns about this legislation, and because many of their employees are part-time, high school age, and I think we already talked about the value of having your first job and being employed. And I think this would probably be hard for employers in this type of industry to give their raises just based on the merit and hard work ethic, is which most employers like to do. And so I know I have some great concerns about this legislation. Thank you.
Representative McNamara. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if my question is for the author, Mr. Rakowski. Representative Winkler, do you know the definition of agriculture and what all are we encompassing? Does this include non-traditional types of agriculture, people growing things other than corn, beans? Would it affect the green industry, the growing of other products?
Mr. Ruskowski.
Representative Carlson, Representative McNamara, agriculture workers are defined in the Fair Labor Standards Act in Chapter 177, and perhaps counsel could be of some, but the definition is already in statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rakowski, would it include folks, for instance, in the growing of the nursery product industry? Would it include them?
Mr. Rakowski.
I'd have to check the statute. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, if you could check that before the committee's over. And related to that, can you give me again, you talked about, I want to be sure I've got this right, a sales tax exemption of $50,000. If that was triggered, I thought you said something to Representative Holberg about they're not measured by their volume, but it's measured by sales tax in this regard. I was not able to follow what you were talking about there. Could you clarify?
Sure. Representative Carlson, Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, the minimum wage and overtime, the federal conformity we're trying to achieve here, it's companies that have a gross annual sales revenue of $500,000 or more are subject to this minimum wage that we're, the higher minimum wage under this bill. The smaller amount would be for companies that have an annual gross revenue of less than $500,000. And companies that are over the $500,000 sales tax revenue, overtime after 40 applies. It doesn't apply for the smaller ones.
Th-
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rakowski, that's what I thought, and I misunderstood what you were saying before, because I thought you were saying it referred to the 40 or 48 hours. That's not that. Yeah, you're talking about the wage increases. Now my question is, and I'm pretty sure, and let's just assume, thank you, Mr. Chair, that the agriculture definition, I believe, does include folks growing non-traditional. I'm pretty sure of that, and I'm going to work off that assumption. Representative Winkler, I know this isn't your bill, but I'm interested to know, we're in the midst of a spring from a four-letter word that begins with the word H, yeah, in regards to the green industry. There's no way one of those folks could be up here today to defend their position, because we've gone from an unbelievable, really, winter that lasted until late April to now it's been 5 days in the 70s. It's unbelievable. Are these folks affected by this change, in that they're now going to change from 48 hours to 40? And do you know if they got a chance to testify in committee? Because I just want to know if they're aware of this change even, because actually they've got things other on their mind other than their employment rules right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I'm not sure what you mean by, I think you said green industry. I'm not sure what industry you're specifically talking about.
The green industry would, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, would include not only the landscape industry, which is operates under different rules, but it would include the growing of trees and bushes. Today in this world, we not only grow corn and beans, but we have a multi-billion dollar industry, very prominent in my district and Representative Schoen's district, by people like Bailey Nursery and all kinds of small people that grow trees and bushes, and they compete across the whole nation. They grow in Oregon, they grow in Washington, Iowa, and they also grow in Minnesota. And I believe they're directly affected, this industry, by this legislation. And I'm wondering if they were aware, or did they get a chance to testify when this bill was heard in committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I'm sorry about the green industry. Everybody wants to call themselves the green industry now, so I wasn't aware that you were specifically talking about trees in landscaping. I'm not sure. I was not in the committee when Representative Metza presented his bill, so I don't know if they presented. And to the point from Dolly, whether or not tree farming is agriculture under statute, I suspect it probably is, because I don't know what other type of industry category that would fall under. So they would presumably be affected by this. I'm not aware of whether they testified in the Jobs Committee or not. Presumably, if they're part of a trade association or other industry groups, we've certainly had landscaping companies. I think Gertens came and testified on the minimum wage bill in the Senate. So there certainly have been representatives in that industry aware of these bills as they're moving and have participated. I can't give you chapter and verse on when they knew it and what they testified about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, that helps to know that there was some folks involved. Members, I, as long as I still have the floor, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go to the second part. This is troubling to me. This is unfortunate. We continue to erode the opportunities for us to grow and keep businesses here in Minnesota, and we're pushing them out of the state. But actually, the worst part of this bill is the increase in the wages without a two-tiered system. Recently, my wife and I had dinner at a Hastings restaurant, and the waitress that waited on us said, "Hey, Denny, I really hate to bother you," which I always laugh when people say that. All of you know that's our job. They're supposed to bother us, and whether we're in the grocery store, the restaurant, or in church, and yesterday it was in church about the marriage thing, but this was having dinner a few Fridays or Saturdays ago, and the waitress said, "You know, Denny, please, please, if you're going to raise the minimum wage, we need a two-tier system. We need tip credit." This was the waitress. And I thought, wow, this is weird. I know she used to work at the country club, and now she's down at this cafe. And it's one that had been closed and reopened, and the lady's doing a great job opening it. She says, "I do the bookwork part-time because I don't get enough hours waitressing. Denny, you don't need to increase my pay. I'm already well over $20 an hour. If you raise the minimum wage, I'm going to get a $2 raise." The busboy, the cooks, the cleaning staff are making $9 to $10 an hour. She can't afford to give them a raise when we all get a raise. It makes no sense, folks. This is backwards. Today in the metropolitan area, the busboys, the cooks, and the cleaning staff are working for $9, $10 an hour. The cafe owner doesn't have an unlimited amount of money. Those are the people that deserve the raise. And when we give the waiter or the waitress a raise, the other ones don't get it. Look at our downtowns. We've got a great restaurant closed today because it couldn't survive. And Representative Simon, what's happened since 05? These people have hardly gotten a raise because the waitresses got a raise. They were making $8, $9 an hour then. Now they're making $9, $10. And you know what's going to happen? We're going to go to iPads in the restaurants instead of getting to work with these people. Please don't do this. This is absolutely wrong. It was wrong when Governor Pawlenty did it, and it's wrong now. I'm like Representative Abler. I actually want to increase the minimum wage. But doggone it, why do you want to give the waiter and waitress who's making $22 an hour now another raise, and the cook and the busboy and the cleaning staff get jilted again? They're not going to. It's not an unlimited pot. Please, members, talk to your cafe owners. Talk to the folks and understand the implications of this. Representative Winkler, you're very, very bright. You are. I mean, you are way ahead of wherever I could be. You know this stuff. You get this. You're carrying this bill. Please, please do the right thing, because this idea that they can just tap it and give. Go ask a busboy, a cook, and a cleaning staff how much they make. They're not going to get a raise. They're already making $9, $10 an hour because the market drives that. This is so wrong. Members, please don't do this.
Okay, just a comment. On February 27th, I just counted, there were 29 testifiers on House File 92. On March 7th, and that was before, let's see, what committee was that? The joint meeting, okay, of the two committees that would have jurisdiction, the Jobs Committee on March 7th. There were several testifiers there. I didn't do a count on that. 10, I guess, okay. And then on March 12th, looks like there must have been a like number. And on March 7th, the greenhouse industry was represented by two testifiers in terms of your question. So just for information in terms of the number of testifiers.
But Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, the amendment is the Metsa bill. I mean, I think that's what people are concerned with.
I said Representative Holbrook on the minimum wage. And that's...
But again, Mr. Chair, the issue that Denny was bringing up is the 48-hour overtime threshold versus 40, and that was not a part of House File 92. We're seeing that before us in a policy amendment here in committee, and I think his point is valid. When you got to get stuff planted after months of frozen ground, maybe you can't do it in 40 hours a week.
Okay, well, I just wanted to point out there were a lot of people that testified on the minimum wage. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, I kind of wanted to piggyback a little bit off of what Representative Poppy pointed out. Can you tell me for example, the dairy industry, what are the guidelines that Wisconsin has that tends to be one of our top competitors when it comes to dairy? Can you tell me what their rules are for our ag employers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I believe the testimony from Dolly was that there is no state overtime requirement, and therefore agricultural workers in Wisconsin have no overtime number because it is exempted under the federal law.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, but we're changing it here, as I understand it, for the state of Minnesota. Am I reading it correctly, Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, correct. We are changing it from a 48-hour state standard to a 40-hour state standard, which applies to all workers who do not fit under the 40-hour federal exemption.
Okay, and
federal standard,
Mr.
Rather.
Chair and Representative Winkler, can you tell me, how does the Minnesota milk producers feel about this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it is my understanding that they are not supportive of this change. And I would just like to respond briefly to where I think you're going and where Representative Poppe was. You know, there are a lot of industries that are weather dependent, and I don't have a particular reason to think that agricultural workers need to make work 48 hours before they hit an overtime requirement when workers in virtually every other industry have a 40-hour requirement under federal law and would under state law as well. So maybe there is something unique and special about agriculture that says that 48 hours should be the overtime standard, but I have not heard anybody articulate it. I understand that the industry likes it that way. I appreciate that they like it that way. But there's no industry that wouldn't like us to have easier rules and regulations for workplace standards and every other kind of standard. They would all like it to be a lighter touch from government. But the fact is that we have labor standards that apply to virtually every other industry, and I just don't know that I have heard a compelling argument for why agriculture should be treated differently.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, did you actually talk to the Minnesota milk producers or any ag community at all, soybean growers, the corn growers, any of those folks? Did you actually reach out and talk to them about this issue at all, you personally?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, no. This was not my bill as it came through the committee. It was Representative Metz's bill, and it was at the instigation of the Department of Labor and Industry.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, I understand that there is maybe somebody from the Minnesota milk producers here or the corn growers or the soybean growers. If they could come down and speak to this, I'd really appreciate hearing their input on this. In particular, one of the questions that I have for their organization is, I know that typically if you're a small farm operation, you know, under that $50,000 threshold, you are typically hiring a high school kid, one, to get their feet wet. They can determine if this is something that they want to do as a career later on in life. Can you tell me how many of those employees of a farm operation are under the age of 18 or 18 or younger? If there's somebody from the farm community.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, my name is Kevin Wally. I represent the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. The specific question, I believe, is how many of the ag workers are under the age of 18. And I know that traditionally there has been an effort made by local farmers to hire help from their high schools. I will say that there has been sort of a change in culture over the past 10 years or so, and fewer of the workers that are employed are from the high school ranks. And so I would guess that number is rather small. There's something over 4,000 dairy operations in the state, and there's probably a full half of them that are perhaps managed within a family without adding very much, if any, outside labor assistance. And so we're probably looking at half or so of the dairy operations that do hire outside labor. And while there are, it's certain that there are many that hire local high school students as their help, as I said, that number is diminishing or has diminished over the past decade or so.
Mr. Chair and
Anderson.
Mr. Wally, can you help me out and tell me what kind of what footing does this put Minnesota dairy farmers or corn growers or soybean growers, what kind of footing does this place them on when it comes to trying to make ends meet? I know it's a very competitive market. I know at least for the dairy producers, they don't get to set their own price. Can you tell me how this impacts them at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, as Representative Poppe mentioned, and as Representative Winkler mentioned as well, Minnesota is a bit of an island in the nation with respect to the labor standard or threshold for overtime compared to other states. Many states, in fact, most states, rely upon the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act exemption from overtime. In Wisconsin, there is no overtime threshold. It's up to the employer to provide a threshold. In Iowa, the law states that there's overtime only in circumstances where the employment agreement between the workers and the manager provides for overtime. And so we are already at the 48-hour threshold, somewhat more strict with respect to the overtime that's paid to agricultural workers, whether it be in animal agriculture, through dairy or hog operations or poultry. or the crop harvesting ventures, corn, soybeans, wheat, whatever.
Great. And Mr. Chair, I also had a question for, I saw that Mr. McElroy was here. I was hoping that he could come down and speak a little bit about how this will impact some of the greater Minnesota restaurant establishments that we have. You know, I think some of the members have expressed that they don't think that this will impact in the metro area, but let's at least take a look. How is this going to impact greater Minnesota, in particular the border communities? And let's say, for example, let's look at what's happened in the area of Moorhead. They've had some significant challenges over the last couple of years, obviously, with our tax system that we have in place that has made us very anti-competitive in comparison to North Dakota. What does this do for the Moorhead area? How many restaurants have they lost within the last 5 years, and is there any predictions that you can give me on what this will mean for those folks if this goes into place?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, for the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Restaurant Association. The Moorhead is a great example. Some of you may recall the Moorhead City Council commissioned a study as to what they could do to get more restaurants in Moorhead. It has been a priority of the Moorhead Business Association and Fargo-Moorhead Chamber to address this. The issue has been less fewer restaurants in Moorhead, but fewer table service or full service restaurants in Moorhead. They have gotten some fast casual restaurants that don't have the high paying jobs table service has. Table service has been growing in Fargo. Minnesota companies like Doolittle's Air Cafe and Lucky 13 and Ruby Tuesdays and others have been, I'm sorry, Rudy's Red Eye Grill and others have been growing on the Moorhead side. I'm sorry, on the Fargo side and not on the Moorhead side. Now, in fairness, the population is higher on the Fargo side, but costs are also lower there. They are one of the 43 states that use a provision of the Fair Labor Standards Act that we no longer support, but it requires tipped employees to use a portion of their tips to get up to the federal minimum wage. The cash wage in North Dakota is $4.89, so it provides a couple of dollars cost advantage. They also have some other small tax differences, sales tax things. We support a different approach that would allow keeping tipped employees at the current $7.25 if they make $12 or more an hour in tips and wages. But the issue in border communities particularly has been an attraction to a full service across the border. When there's growth in our border communities, they have tended to be lower labor cost concepts like order at the counter.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a series of questions, and maybe I'll call down the soybean or the milk producer people. But for the Department of Labor and Industry, I'm wondering if they have the statistic as to how many people this bill will affect. Is it 1,000? Is it 80,000? Is it 800,000?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, the bill in its entirety you're referring to?
As it's amended in present form in front of us today.
Mr. Chairman, I've been asked this during the session, how many employers pay the minimum wage?
We want to know the employees.
I mean, we don't know that. I mean, Target could certainly pay some folks the minimum wage and the restaurant down the street. We, again, I want to reiterate, our job is to track employees' wage and hours for the purposes of compliance with the law. So I would assume that smaller businesses would be, generally speaking, more affected than the larger companies that have an annual sales tax revenue of $500,000 or more, because that's when the federal law goes into compliance, and this wouldn't affect them.
Mr. Chair, I believe the testifier misunderstood my question. How many employees, people that work on a wage, hourly wage, will this bill affect?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Ruskowski,
thank you for that clarification. That I can answer. Approximately 93,000 Minnesotans earn the federal earn less than the $7.25, and of those, to the hospitality industry is well aware of, 42,000 of them are employed in the eating and drinking establishments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So, just so everyone understands, a living wage in this state has been classified for a number of years at $13.50 an hour. We are bringing minimum wage to $9. Actually, I think it's not quite $9. It is $8 the first year, $9 the second year, and $9.50 the third year, I believe. So, to the testifier, or to Mr. Rakowski, do you have the number of employees that work below living wage?
Hold on one second. I might have that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I can maybe shed a little bit of light on your questions. If the minimum wage fully phased in for large employers were to went up to $9.80 an hour, and I understand this bill goes up to $9.50, but just to give you an idea, if we went to $9.80, it would be approximately 400,000 Minnesotans would receive a pay increase. So at $9.50 an hour, it's south of 400,000, but it's, you know, 350 to 400,000 Minnesotans would receive a pay increase. That is because while 93 or 97,000 people may be at or near the current minimum wage, by raising it to that level, you're capturing a lot of people who are currently making between $7.50 and $9.50 an hour. So the bottom line, based on the estimates that have, you know, been done by economists, is we're looking at about 400,000 people receiving a wage increase as a result of moving to $9.80, a little less at $9.50. Furthermore, this is a previous point raised by Representative Abler, in which I think he's incorrect. If you look at the statewide job openings right now, statewide, the median hourly wage for a job opening in Minnesota is about $9.87 an hour, something like that. It's south of $10 an hour is the median. That means half of the job openings in the state pay less than the current minimum wage proposal, half pay more. 60% of the job openings are part-time, and almost none of them provide benefits. So if you want to look at a picture of what the jobs are out there, the fact it's not a rural metro issue. That's a statewide number. The job openings in the metro area are low paid. They are part-time, most of them. They don't pay benefits, and it's an even worse picture in greater Minnesota. So the fact is that we have really kind of let these myths about the minimum wage and who's making it inform our decision making. They're not true. 60+% of the workers on making minimum wage are age 25 and older. Over 50% of them are using their income to support families. These are not teenage jobs. These are jobs that are using people are using and working in to support families across the state of Minnesota, not just in greater Minnesota, but in the metro area as well. So a raise in the minimum wage would be a substantial and significant increase in the purchasing power and the ability of people who work to be able to support themselves and their families. And I would, you know, I don't want to get into a long rhetorical discussion of ways and means. I've mostly been trying to answer the questions. But the fact is that there's been a lot of misinformation that informs, I think, bad decisions on the minimum wage. It's been a long time in coming to get here.
We have seven people on the list, and I think after those seven, we'll try to vote on the amendment and then vote on the bill as amended. What I'd like to do is avoid coming back after session this evening. We've got four other bills on the agenda, and session starts at 3, so that might mean a late start. So if people can keep their questions brief, I've been trying to give some latitude here. I think we should keep in mind that there's been a lot of testimony on the minimum wage generally in previous committees. I think it's fair that people are asking about some of the things that perhaps are new in the amendment, but let's kind of keep focused here and get through the list as rapidly as we can. I guess there's 8 on the list. Okay. Nornes, Representative Nornes. Oh, you're not done?
No, I'm not done. I have sat through an hour of listening to the other side of the aisle do everything they possibly can to pump up business and say it's all business, it's all business, it's all business. Where the hell are the workers in this particular argument? I'm a little tired of listening to this. I want to hear from the Department of Labor and Industry. How many people in this state work under a living wage job? How many work under $13.50 an hour?
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
I thought you were done, but I apologize for that. I'm just trying to move things along.
I'll remind the committee, we have about 3 million workers in this state. About 1.5 million of them are hourly workers, and 93,000 make less than $7.25. To Representative Mahoney's question, how many make $13 an hour or less? I don't have that information in front of me right now, but I have it at the office, and it's a large majority. It's probably over half.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So over likely over half make less than a living wage in this state.
Up to
$13 an hour. I have so many notes here, it's almost hard to get to. One of my concerns here, one of my questions is for the egg industry. We all know that there's a certain large retailer who is the largest, whose employers are the largest users of MA in the state, medical assistance and food stamps. I'd kind of like to know how many of the farm workers are on medical assistance and food stamps. Have they left the room? Would they like to come and talk about how many people are taking public subsidies to subsidize the farm industry here?
Mr. Wally.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I don't know the exact numbers, and it does vary from farm to farm how managers provide benefits to their workers.
Well, Mr. Wally, that you probably don't want to know that answer and probably don't want to have that particular answer, because if they're making $400 a week, which is what they'd have to make to be exempted from this, they can't afford to live.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I would point out we're not opposed to the minimum wage provisions in this bill.
Great. That's a wonderful idea.
Our concern is with that the overtime threshold provision, the change from the 48 down to the 40 hours, and that's what I wanted to speak to. Now, your question's a legitimate one. I don't know the answer. I do know that there are dairy operations that provide health benefits. There are those who provide like health savings accounts, and there are those who provide no such benefits. And so it really is all over the board.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question, and then I'll make a couple of closing remarks and leave this go. Representative Winkler, do you know how long it's been since a student at the University of Minnesota could work a minimum wage job and pay their tuition rather than take out $40,000 or $50,000 worth of debt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't know what year we crossed that threshold. The information I have now, however, indicates that a student would have to work 150 hours a week at minimum wage in order to be able to afford tuition at the University of Minnesota. I think that's because tuition has gone up and because the average wages for workers have been flat or declining for decades.
Mr. Chair, members of this committee, I heard this bill in my committee. I heard Representative Metz's, and I heard Representative Winkler's bill in my committee. Fully vetted. And the thing that has always amazed me about this bill is the sides that are broken up. It's going to hurt business. And it's a small number of businesses. It's going to hurt business. And it's a small number of businesses that will be hurt. Yes. I'm totally sorry about that. I get that, how hard it is to create businesses in this state. There are not many other legislators up here that work as hard as I do to create businesses in this state. But when we have a difficult time raising the wages of the lowest paid people in this state, and we're not even raising this wage to a living wage, we are just getting them a few more vegetables on the table. I am shocked. I have a few other words, but I'm going to be kind and gentle to my colleagues here. But I just have a very difficult time with the idea that we can't help over half the workers in this state. And Representative Winkler, I am grateful that you took this amendment. And this amendment helps women bond with their children. It helps mothers and fathers spend more time with their kids. You know, there used to be a compact. 8 hours of rest, 8 hours of work, and 8 hours of family. That seems to have gone by the wayside, and it's time America and Minnesota and this world get back to that particular attitude.
Okay, we have Representative Honey, you're done?
Yes, I'm done.
Okay, Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question, and I was just thinking of a lot of high-paying jobs in my local hospital that are going away because of a $800,000 surcharge that's being placed on them. Those are good jobs that are going away. But specifically to this amendment, we're assuming the jobs are still going to be there. I visited with a young businessman who operates a very nice high-quality steakhouse, a restaurant, and a catering service. And he's not aware of this amendment, but just in general, the bill originally raising the minimum wage would cost him about $60,000 a year in additional overhead. And just by coincidence, his profit for the year is about $60,000. Now, why would he stay in business? Why would he keep the door open? Because you can't raise your price to offset that expense. So I'm just relaying what he told me. And it's very serious. I'm sure that there's others that probably would have the same story. So these businesses, I mean, we're going to lose some. He also had a fire on top of everything else. But I'm very much supportive of business and employees, but we need both.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'll direct this to you, and if you want to direct the question to someone else, but I'm still trying to determine. Now, the amendment we're putting on is Representative Metz's bill, and do you know, Mr. Chair, Representative Metz's bill, what is referred to, I believe, Representative Mahoney's committee, and Representative Mahoney indicated that it was heard in committee, but it was not reported out. Is that correct?
Representative Mahoney, did you hear the question?
Mr. Chair, I think I actually can answer it, and I just conferred. The Metz bill is on the General Register, and this amendment is not just the Metz bill. This is also an amendment to reduce the minimum wage rates that were currently previously in House File 92.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, to Representative Winkler, so Representative Metz's bill was reported out of committee. I was a little confused about that because I thought Representative Mahoney indicated they heard it, but I didn't hear that it was actually reported out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I was misinformed. Actually, it is still in the Jobs Committee. It was laid over. It was not reported out.
All right. So,
excuse me. You said, or whomever, Representative Mahoney has hand up that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I held that bill over with the intent of putting it into the omnibus jobs bill. I was advised that that was probably the wrong place to put it, and we needed to bring the minimum wage and this amendment to the House floor in a separate bill. I still think it should have been in the jobs bill because there's a $350 million tax cut that probably would have paid for it.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from a process standpoint, was there a vote in committee on Representative Metz's bill in your committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, yes, there was not a vote because it was held over. I think there was audible yeses for the bill, but people didn't realize it was being held over.
All right, thank you. And so, Mr. Chair, so there was no vote in the Jobs Committee on the bill, and if the bill had been reported out, would it have traveled to another committee? I know that the minimum wage bill was heard in several committees. I know we heard it in Commerce Committee. I'm just wondering if Representative Metz's bill would have been referred to another committee as well.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, because my intent with Representative Metz's bill was to keep it and put it into the jobs bill, I never fully look to see if it needed to go to any other particular committees, but I know Representative Winkler's bill had gone to a variety of other committees, so I suspect that Winkler's bill would have gone also.
Representative Lund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would Representative Atkins yield to a question? I'm wondering if, as the chair of the Commerce Committee, if he perhaps would have sought to have Representative Metz's bill heard in the Commerce Committee if it had been reported out of the Jobs Committee.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, yes, we would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would Representative Poppe yield to a question? I'm wondering if as chair of the Agriculture Policy Committee, if she might have sought to hear the Metz's bill in her committee as well.
I would say that's likely, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think the point I'm trying to make here is we are indeed hearing significant policy that has not actually been voted on or reported out of any other committee. I understand it was heard, but that is not our process here. Certainly anyone can offer an amendment on the floor according to our rules. But, Mr. Chair, I've just got to raise this as, again, a continuing concern of how we're handling some of these issues through the Ways and Means Committee. There is a process in which bills are to be heard and reported out. And we have deadlines, and we also have a Rules Committee to make exceptions to that when necessary. But, you know, if this was incredibly important, and Representative Mahoney and others have been very impassioned about this, I guess I just have to wonder then why it wasn't reported out of his committee and moved along the process. Representative Winkler, also, I have heard from folks representing the long-term care industry and nursing homes express concern about this. And, you know, while I might have concerns about other aspects of the bill on employment opportunities and that, I think long-term care presents a real unique situation here because, as you know, our state laws also, we have rate equalization requirements and they are not allowed to just raise their rates to accommodate required pay increases if that's the impact on them from this. So I'm wondering if you have talked at some length with those folks and have you come to any solutions or thoughts on that particular issue. And Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's anyone in the audience from representing the long-term care, but if they have any comments to share, I would certainly like to hear that as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lund, I think the question was
Representative
Winkler. Yes, I have spoken with them. It is my understanding, and after having a fairly direct conversation about it, that they don't oppose raising the minimum wage. They simply want us as legislators and policymakers to be aware that the impact of our budgeting affects their businesses and affects their ability to pay workers more. We are in situations in many small towns where workers are quitting their jobs at nursing homes and going to work at Menards or Walmart or other places because those sort of famously parsimonious employers actually pay more than local nursing homes do, in large part because of our budgeting. And I understand that legislators are concerned about the impact, but the bottom line for the people that I've spoken with is raise the minimum wage, but use it as an opportunity to highlight the impact our budgets have on their businesses.
And Representative Loon, for your information, you should have had one of these distributed. They provided us with written testimony.
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I just wondered if there was anyone here representing the industry that would like to add to whatever's on that written piece of paper.
If you could identify yourself for the record, and I'm going to ask all witnesses, not just because you're coming forward, but to be brief so that we can have an opportunity for all the members to ask their questions.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Christian Knights. I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota.
I'd just like to add to what Representative Winkler said. We did have a meeting with him where we discussed the impact of the minimum wage. And what our members have told us is that we do have a bill that's been put forward that tries to increase rates by 5% and 5% each year. And 75% of that is supposed to go to the caregivers. So we greatly support increasing wages to go to our caregivers because it's needed. The challenge that is presented within the minimum wage context is, as Representative Winkler stated, because we're so dependent upon Medicaid rates, and then federally on Medicare, which is also being cut, there's a margin issue for us. We can't afford to pay as much to our caregivers. And as a result, I'd just like to point out on the letter dated March 5th that was circulated to members, the number has actually changed. The underfunding is now putting, instead of 85 nursing homes across the state at an operating margin, it's now 115 as the new updated numbers came in from last year. So it poses a great difficulty. Our members tell us that we'd like to pay more to our caregivers. Our caregivers and seniors deserve that. But it does present a challenge as to how we get the revenue because of the rate equalization to actually pay those wages.
You represent alone?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Pearson. Just one last question, perhaps, for Mr. Pearson. So, you know, with that updated information, it sounds like we have a, a growing problem with nursing homes being at risk and their operating margins. So, I mean, is the policy we're debating today, and I don't think many of us would argue that folks taking care of our elderly work incredibly hard and deserve every penny that we could possibly give them. But it seems to me that we've got, you know, government policies here that are really putting you in a pretty severe bind. Would you agree with that?
Whichever one of you wants to address it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. Between the policy and the lack of reimbursement, 4 years of flat rates, it puts our nursing home facilities in a difficult situation. And no one silver bullet is going to fix that. And our caregivers deserve increased wages. Our members just tell us that the policy of increasing the minimum wage past a certain threshold is going to create big problems for them. And currently our members have said that the threshold in these bills is too high for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, the testifier.
Representative Houseman on this issue.
Yes, Mr. Chair, to just follow up. So she had a direct question to this bill, and I want to just restate that. So you're saying your problem in your industry is if we pass this bill, or is it years of state and federal budgets that starve your industry?
Representative Houseman, Mr. Chair, I think you kind of hit it right on the head as well. It's the combination of both of those things. We've had, on the state level, for the state sets the Medicaid rate, we've had flat rate increases for the last 4 years. Obviously, no increases means it makes it difficult to pay your caregivers more each year. The state controls the majority of the funding that comes into nursing homes because of the rate equalization law, which says you can't charge private pay any more than the rate that you charge for Medicaid. So that means there's nowhere else to turn. And then, as you point out, on the federal level, with the Medicare cuts coming into place, the facilities that actually do Medicare as a part of their mix of payment are seeing cuts on that side. The combination of those things, on both from a funding source perspective, we have nowhere else to turn, as well as policy provisions that have been adopted, makes it very difficult for our nursing facilities to operate.
And so, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, might it not be better? We've spent the majority of this time having people asked to this table to talk about what's wrong with this bill. But what you're describing is years of a different kind of activity, of our refusing to recognize that maybe there needs to be more revenue put into an industry like this, and that our time would be better spent. How do we protect the industry, and how do we protect the workers that make that industry happen? I mean, what we're getting set up today is the antagonistic employer or industry versus the worker. And ultimately, what I'm hearing is that's not going to get us to a better place. Your workers are still all going to leave to go to the retailers that are now paying more.
Mr. Chair, Representative Houseman, we have, as you point out, for each of the last 4 years, we've come in pointing out that we need increases to give caregivers increased wages. Every year, we put in bills that say increase nursing home workers' wages. This year we worked with many of our union friends on getting a 5% and 5% increase. In many ways, those are similar and related, but they're not the same thing, as you point out. We fully recognize that we need to give caregivers better wages, and we come in and every year we ask for more. That's the way the system's set up. That's how we have to come and ask for our raises. It just is a fact of how we have to come and advocate for our caregivers. And then this policy issue is a separate one, as you point out, where it's not necessarily we're opposed to the idea. In fact, we support giving our caregivers more wages. We just have to come to you to ask for the money. And when we ask for the money and we don't get it, that's when this policy starts to impinge upon our ability to recruit and retain our caregivers.
And, Mr. Chair, just, I guess, a concluding comment then. You know, what's happening today is the business and industry section is being used to come up to this table in opposition to this bill. At a certain point, if we don't break out of that ideological divide and start working together on the issue of revenue appropriately funding, unless we get, if we get to that point, maybe we also build a better industry and a better state. But that if we're stuck in this ideological divide, business and industry, we're never going to get to a better point.
Okay, Representative Gunther, I think you had a question of the same people.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I get a kick out of the fact that the state determines the rate that nursing homes get. The state determines the staffing levels, the ratios that have to be there. What are these business people, these people that manage these facilities, and there's seven or eight of them in my district, and every time I see them, I'm in for at least a half-hour lecture on what we're doing wrong. What can we do? They've taken away the health benefits. They've taken away the retirement benefits. They've taken away every benefit they've had. And yet we determine here what the reimbursement level is there, and we are the ones that are causing them to have really a sub-minimum wage and a sub-minimum life. It's time that we do something for the largest employer in seven of my towns, which is a nursing home. It's time that we do something to take care of those people that were fighting wars to make us safe, from inventing things that will cure our sicknesses in life, made things easy for us. What do we do in return for them? We starve them to death. Thank you.
Hey, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, we've spent a lot of time focused on the minimum wage portion of the A-12 amendment. I wanted to drop us down to lines 3.27 to 3.31, extending the parental leave. And I'm going to try to pull a couple of things together. I think you know that on international rankings by the OECD, the United States ranks, I think, second from the bottom in our competitor nations in the industrialized world for our family-friendly policies in the workforce. And this clearly is much more family-friendly. And while around here we like to put things into dualities, it's red versus blue or black versus white or business versus labor, what research shows is that if you do family-friendly policies like parental leave, you actually get increased productivity, decreased absenteeism, and decreased turnover. Those are all big expenses for employers. If I have to train somebody new in, that's a big expense if they don't then stay on. So while we talk about this as being a net negative, it actually, the research shows across the country, is a net positive for businesses in their ability to attract and retain workers. I remain concerned, though, that, you know, positive step forward. This morning, the Pew Trust folks released some information that between 2009 and 2011, the mean net worth of the upper 7% of the country increased 28%. Over those same 2 years, the mean net worth of the lower 93% decreased 4%. So maybe I'll ask two questions of you. Without the minimum wage increase that you propose in the bill, what percentage of new parents won't be able to take full advantage of the increased parental leave because they simply won't be able to stay home with their kids?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davney, it's kind of a curious thing. I'm trying to avoid speechifying as the author of a bill in order to allow the committee more time to ask questions in order to them to make speeches on behalf of my bill, but well done.
Thank you. High praise.
The fact is that Representative Mahoney mentioned this. In Minnesota, a family of four with two parents working, two children, both parents need to make $14 an hour in order to have a basic bare-bones budget. And with the median wage of new job openings at less than $10 an hour, the fact is that, you know, with, I can't give you a number, a percentage of people making minimum wage who can take 12 weeks. The answer very likely is close to zero. And in fact, many of them can't take 6 weeks. The number is very close to zero. And people rely on family networks and extended social networks, but they also significantly rely on public assistance in order to do to make ends meet and to do things that are really basic. What's interesting to me is that the four industries with the highest that are the highest users of public assistance with workers working full time are in retail, food service, healthcare, and temp agencies. So we really are talking about a large share of the workforce that is working in very low-wage jobs, dependent on public assistance to get by, and this 12-week leave policy is just an abstraction for the vast majority of those folks. It does make a difference for a lot of other people, especially women, however. In Minnesota, women make about 80% of what men make across the board, and one of the strongest things that we can do to erase that gender pay gap is to make workplaces more flexible, because the reality is women tend to be the caregivers. So I think it would make a big difference for women. I'm not sure that the 12 weeks would make a big difference for low-wage workers.
Mr. Chair, I'll just thank you, Representative Winkler. You know, we hear a lot of rhetoric about supporting families from both sides of the aisle. This is one place where we can actually do something and move beyond the rhetoric. So I appreciate that opportunity. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, appreciate the discussion. And for the folks watching out, you might wonder why we're spending an hour and 45 minutes on the First Amendment to a bill that we're trying to move as a final committee. And I think the answer to that question is the fact that the process here is incorrect. Representative Loon pointed out that the reason that we're having these discussions is in the Ways and Means Committee is that we're not having a Ways and Means discussion. You know, we're supposed to be having a discussion that we could have had in Health Finance Committee on why we're not funding our folks properly and the differences between funding folks in the community-based services versus our nursing homes. That would have been a good discussion, and how that might play into that should have been in the Health Finance Committee. Representative Hausman, you probably could have gotten a better answer to your question. Perhaps you would have liked to have attended that Health and Human Services Finance Committee, where we say, why are we, when we're spending $3 billion in additional taxes, why are we cutting Health and Human Services $150 million instead of adding to places that could contribute to workers in home health and community-based services and in our nursing homes? In Representative Poppe's committee, we could have had answers to questions about why can't we just hire everybody on the farm on a salary? That sounds like a good idea. 8 hours of sunlight, 8 hours of work, and 8 hours of rest. That sounds like a good idea. You know, I'm guessing that in the Ag committee, we might have had a discussion where folks could have weighed in. I had an interesting conversation on the floor the other day with Representative Keel, and I said, how's the crops coming? Deb, how's the crops coming? Well, she's got ice, she's got water in the fields, Lon is trying to get all the equipment ready, and she's going to have to plant. She says, we're going to go at 24s, and I didn't know what that meant. What's 24s? They're going to have to go 24 hours a day to get their crop in because of the availability of equipment, And I didn't know this, but in order to plant certain stuff, the dirt has to be at a certain temperature, and it ain't there right now. So they'd love to be out there 8 hours of sunshine, 8 hours of planting, and 8 hours of sleeping, but it don't work that way if you're a farmer, said the guy from suburban Minnesota. So I think that, Representative Winkler, this isn't your fault. Your bill's on the minimum wage, and you've brought it along, and this is a marriage of, this is kind of a shotgun wedding here in wage and ways and means. And Representative Carlson said, is there anybody here who should think that these two should not be wed at this time? Raise your hand. Well, you're seeing a bunch of hands. That's what happens when we do the process this way. And I wish that we could have had these referred back to the committees, and I'm sure that there will probably be a motion to do so. But my question to Representative Winkler is procedural and is short, and I apologize for the speech, but that's kind of the position we're put in. Your amendment in between where it was and where it is has some changes to it, and I'm wondering there's been some accusations, well, this side of the aisle has opposition. As you know, that this is not a bonding bill. You can pass this with 68 votes, and you can move things through with your caucus only and work with the governor's office. Has the governor weighed in, and is that why these changes are made? Is he said that he will only sign something at a certain rate for your minimum wage? Has he said thus far and no more, and is that why this has changed? And if not, what is the temperament of the governor for moving the minimum wage bill forward, and has he given you guidance on what he will or won't sign?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the only knowledge I have of what the governor's position on this is a comment he made a number of weeks ago, and I think he referenced a number somewhere between 9 and 950. Frankly, my concern is more with the Minnesota Senate, as I'm sure you're well aware from the last 2 years.
Okay, Representative Clark. Representative Clark, you were on the list.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, we had quite a bit of testimony both from the audience and from some members on the tip credit and the sub-minimum wage idea for those workers. I'm just wondering if we have anybody in the room who could testify on the other side of that issue.
Is there anybody that would like to come forward? If you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Wade Luneberg, Secretary Treasurer of Unite Here, Local 17, and also the Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota State Council of Unite Here Unions. We are very much in support of raising the minimum wage here in Minnesota. It's something that's been really long in coming, as Representative Winkler has pointed out. We wait too long to wait to raise the minimum wage, and so we find ourselves in this bind all the time. And so we believe that the minimum wage should go up significantly and then tie it to inflation. We think that that's an appropriate and good legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know there's always this idea that some of our waiters and waitresses are overpaid, and I think there was a little debunking of that along the way here, but I think the importance that you might add, or the information you might add about the actual wage that people take home, and also you know, who these people are, that they're not just people who are necessarily working for... They're people who need to make the money that they're making, and they're supporting families, and they're not just doing a short job, a job for a short time.
That's right. You know, folks in our industry, I think, oh, pardon me, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think that there are many misconceptions about my industry, and I'll be specific to hospitality. Hospitality Minnesota would describe itself on its own homepage as a $10 billion industry with 265,000 workers. Minnesota's, I think, second largest industry, and plans growth rates of 14% over 10 years, and that includes the Great Recession. Hospitality is not hurting in Minnesota, I'm happy to say. It is usually growing, and in the case of the recent recession, was really the first industry to bounce back, which is not surprising. It's we are more and more becoming part of a service sector economy here in Minnesota. People like to buy things, and people like to be taken care of. And so we believe that the best path to recovery here from this challenging economy is to actually make sure that low-wage workers and their families are part of the recovery.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's see, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for the long-term care folks, if they could come back up to the table. And as you're coming down, here's the question for you to think about. And folks that have come to me that do the in-home care, in particular, their concern was pay for folks that are sleeping over. Do you know how many employees are actually live in, and what that kind of impact would be on those folks? And I know that, and this is also for Representative Winkler, I know that in some states what they do is they have a different exception for employees that are live-in, and it's you're paying them basically for sleeping and staying overnight. Do you have that as part of this amendment at all? And what are your thoughts on that at all? So first for the care folks.
Sure. Which one of you would like to? No, I think your first name is Christian?
Yes, it is.
What was the last name?
Knights. Christian Knights with Aging Services of Minnesota. Representative Anderson, we don't have exact figures on that. We can look into it. Kind of confirm, we would think it would be more on the disability side for the home and community-based piece that might be where you're thinking of those workers than particularly on the nursing home side.
Okay. And Representative Winkler, I haven't had a chance to read through all of your amendment. Do you provide an exception for folks at all that are basically they're getting paid to sleep in a home? Do you have anything like that at all? Because some states actually do that. Do you have anything like that in this amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there is no distinction in the bill for different types of employment. If you are on the clock, you are getting paid the minimum wage.
Okay, so there's no exception at all that you've got on here. Have you looked at other states that have done that, Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I have not, and I generally would not support such a provision. It seems to me that if you're not at your home or on your own time, if you're being paid to be in a certain place at a certain time, even if that requires that you sleep there, that is part of your job and you should get paid for it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, have you looked at how this impacts, say, for example, camp counselors, resorts, and things of that nature? Have you talked to any of the camps across the state of Minnesota? These are a lot of our nonprofits that we have. Have you had any communications with them whatsoever on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I have had conversations with people from Cook County in particular who have a lot of international workers coming in over the summer, international students on J-1 visas. They have suggested that we may look at wanting to go from a 90-day training wage to 120-day training wage because sometimes it may bump over the 90-day period. My response has simply been that we're just changing the hourly rate. We're not changing the number of days in the training wage. So it shouldn't be any more complex for them to administer that than it would be under current law.
Well, Mr. Chair, and do we have any of the nonprofits here? I'm just trying to think, I know in Wilmer, actually the Spicer area, that's Representative Sawatsky's district, they've got the Green Lake Bible Camp there. There's also St. Andrews. I'm just wondering if the nonprofit folks have any thoughts on what this means for the camp counselors over a summer period, how long they are able to offer services or anything along those lines, if we've gotten any input from them. And if they're here, I'd love to hear their thoughts on it.
And anybody present from the nonprofits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's my understanding that camp counselors are exempt from minimum wage and overtime laws already.
Okay, so this doesn't apply to them at all. Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's my understanding.
Okay. So just the nonprofits, though, if you are a for-profit, it would.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not sure about the number of for-profit camp, you know, number of camp counselors who are working for for-profits. I suppose if they are in that business, it would apply to them.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
We have Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Representative Winkler, I guess, well, I know that one of my major concerns is being a border community with borders on two different states. The district I'm privileged to represent borders Iowa and Wisconsin. There is a whole, we keep talking about Fargo-Moorhead. Well, I want to talk about Winona and across the river. I want to talk about La Crescent and La Crosse. I'd like to talk about Harmony and Cresco. Very damaging to border communities. So I don't know if we need to put in exceptions for border communities. Another huge concern that I have is for our nursing homes. I am hearing from the nursing homes saying that the minimum wage issue is would possibly shut some of them down. And just so members realize, back on the farm when I was growing up and working, we used to call, you know, think about going from 48 hours to 40. Well, we used to call 40 hours on the farm was Wednesday. And so the talk from Representative Dean about his conversation with Representative Kyle is very critical here in what we're doing in this bill. This is going to be a very, very late season. Their farmers will be going 24/7 and certainly could not in any way comply with any of these state mandates here. I was made aware over the weekend of a company with 200 employees that, with the Affordable Care Act coming forward where it has to be done up by January 1st of 14, their theory was that they would just pay the fines. When they did the numbers, the fines from the Affordable Care Act would be twice what their profits were. So there's an out-state company with 200 employees that is done, and not just because of the minimum wage, but also because of the Affordable Care Act. So, Mr. Chairman, I used to referee football, and between the Affordable Care Act shutting down hundreds of businesses, the minimum wage laying off nursing home workers and others, and the fourth and fifth income tax tiers, the taxes on success, and I know we're here today about the minimum wage, but when I was a football referee, I would have thrown a flag and called it piling on, because that's what we're doing here. This is a very troubling bill, and we have a lot of policy to look at here again in ways and means, and so I hope there'll be some sanity coming out of this legislature at some point. I just haven't seen it yet.
Representative Holger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, the fiscal note on the METSA bill showed impacts in 15, 16, and 17, and I'm wondering if somebody's done the analysis to see if there, any of those costs are carried in the amendment or how it works with the...
Okay, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I believe the fiscal note denotes $71,000. $70,000 of that is in the Department of Labor and Industry, and $1,000, for whatever reason, is in MMB. $70,000 is in the Jobs and Economic Development budget as ongoing in the TAILS money.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, so the METSA language has already been paid for in your bill? Or is it the interaction between the METSA bill and the Winkler bill, is it the same $70,000 or is it a different $70,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, the $70,000 is paid for in my bill, and it is the METSA bill as amended on to Representative Winkler's bill. It doesn't really matter what the wages are, whether they're the previous wage, the amended wage, or Representative Metz's wage. The $70,000 is to inform business groups, communities, labor unions, what the rules are and what the changes are to minimum wage as you index it for inflation. So it's a matter of just getting the message out and then informing the public and the employers and their representatives what the new laws will be and the new wage will be every year.
And Representative Holder. Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, so it's not $140,000, it's the same $70,000 twice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that is my understanding. It's a $140,000 over the biennium.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, on the METSA bill, it shows a $70,000 cost beginning in 15. On the 2E amendment for Winkler, that $70,000 doesn't show up until 16. So do we know what the final impacts and when they occur if the amendment is adopted to the Winkler bill today?
Mr. Martz has indicated, Representative Mahoney, that if he could comment if you'd like him to.
That would be fine.
Mr. Martz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the $70,000 is related to when the cost of the CPA or the Consumer Price Index adjustment goes into effect for the minimum wage. I believe in the METSA bill it was started in 16, the other way around. In the METSA bill it started in 16, and in the House File 92 it starts in fiscal year 15. So it's the same $70,000. It's to notify employers, as Representative Mahoney was saying, once that adjustment takes effect. And Representative Mahoney's Jobs and Economic Development Bill, House File 729, funded it beginning in fiscal year 15.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, do you know what we can receive as legislators as a maximum per diem here in the House?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, I actually don't know because I don't take it. The maximum, that is. I think there are other members in the room who are probably more familiar with the total maximum they could possibly collect.
Is anyone who's on the, Mr. Chair, anyone on the Rules Committee, is it still 76 or is it less than that? Is it 66? Okay, very good. So it's $66 for per diem. Representative Winkler, I see on August 1st, the large employer minimum wage will go to $8 an hour. How much would that be for an 8-hour day?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, I think my math skills suggest that would be $64, which is mighty close to 66.
Very good. And Representative Winkler, that $66 we can take. I know a number of members here take that maximum per day of per diem. What is that for? For legislators.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, the per diem payment, I'd rather not tell you what I really think it's for, but in theory it's for expenses.
So, Representative Winkler, that'd be for expenses above the regular salary we receive as legislators of $31,100 and some change, plus any other job we may have. Would that be correct? It's above and beyond, like food incidentals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, that is correct. We make just above the new August minimum wage just by showing up here on top of our salaries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, this $8 an hour that an employer received, what do they use those dollars for?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, what the evidence suggests is that most people use those money to make ends meet as best they can. Food, rent, transportation, child care if they're in that situation. All of the basics of life that everyone has to cover on their expenses.
Mr. Chair, just one final comment. It's interesting to note here that some of us are not willing to provide the same amount of money in an 8-hour day that someone would need to take care of their entire family, maybe health care, food, insurance, daycare, whatever that might be, that would even equal what we're making as legislators in per diem that is above a regular salary. So we're asking people on less than what we do on the per diem, the incidental, to completely take care of all of their lives when on per diem it's just extra to the salary that we already make. I guess, members, I would think about that.
Okay, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this is a statement, it's not a question for you. But livable wage and legislator salaries are how far apart? Representative Marquardt?
I'm not dealing.
Livable wage. Representative Marquardt.
Livable wage and legislator salaries are how far apart?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Markford.
It sounded like today, Representative Gunter, that about $13 was about, or $14 was a livable wage, which would be about $28,000 a year. And a legislator's salary is about $31,000 plus the per diem.
So they're close.
Well, I would say a legislator's salary would still be above that by probably 20%, counting per diem.
Okay. Representative Mahoney renews the motion that the 92A112 amendment be passed. Any further discussion? Seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hogan.
I'd like to move that House File 92 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture without recommendation and ask for a roll call.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I oppose the motion.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, there's been quite a bit of discussion on what the implications of this new policy of the 48-hour overtime to 40 would be. On that, we've had the chair say that she, if the bill moved separately, that she would have likely asked to hear it. And I think that the experts on the Ag Committee should have an opportunity to know what this policy proposal will do to their industry.
Mm-hmm. Any further discussion? Okay, we'll begin the roll.
Carlson?
No.
Abler?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Ansel, excuse. Atkins?
No.
Beard? Reinhardt?
No.
Clark?
No.
Davids?
Yes.
Dabney?
No.
Dean?
Yes.
Dittmer?
Yes.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hackbarth?
Aye.
Hausman?
No.
Hillstrom?
No.
Holberg?
Yes.
Hornstein?
No.
Huntley, excused. Kahn?
No.
Lincheski? Loon?
Yes.
Mahoney?
No.
Mariani?
No.
Markwart?
No.
McNamara?
Yes.
Mullery?
No.
Norness?
Yes.
Paymar? Pulowski?
No.
Poppy?
Yes.
Simon?
No.
Wagenius?
No.
Woodard?
Yes.
Lincheski?
No.
Okay, being 13 ayes and 18 nays, the motion does not prevail. Representative Mahoney would like to renew the motion that House File. You don't want to move, make motion?
No, I thought we'd already moved.
We just adopted the amendment. We're now going to make the motion that the bill as amended passed. Would you like to make that motion? Okay. Representative Mahoney renews the motion that House File 92, second engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Okay, thank you, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, let's see, the next bill on the agenda then is House File 1451. Representative Winkler, you're on here twice. It's been such a long discussion that I forgot to have the second bill up. This is the I-35W bridge. remnant steel disposition bill, and Representative Hornstein, would you like to make a motion?
Yes. I'd like to move that House File 1451 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Winkler.
And, Mr. Chair, there is an amendment, which is why we are back here. You may recall, members, that this was that I made a motion to re-refer this off the General Register and back to the floor in order to deal with this fiscal issue.
Amendment, Representative Hornstein.
A13-5355. I'd like to move the A13-3505 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Winkler, the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is bill gives authority to MnDOT to give away portions of the steel that is the remnants of the 35W bridge for memorial purposes, for historical purposes, and for other purposes that they, in their discretion, believe are worthwhile. The bill also has some of the proceeds from the sale of the steel flow into the general fund rather than the trunk highway fund. And members, the reason for that is that the state of Minnesota, through the general fund, created a compensation fund for bridge victims. Each of the private industry groups or companies that were part of a lawsuit related to the bridge collapse have, through settlement, contributed to the general fund to reimburse the state of Minnesota for its expenses in compensating victims. And the purpose for having the sale of the bridge steel is to have the trunk highway fund also reimburse, mostly in a symbolic fashion, the general fund for MnDOT's role. And so that's why it shows a loss to the trunk highway fund, a gain to the general fund. And the amendment clarifies that the $22,000 in shipping and handling, if you will, that MnDOT will incur will not be at the cost of the trunk highway fund, but will come out of the general fund proceeds of the steel sale.
Okay, Representative Abel?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and not the amendment, just to the whole thing. I just, this isn't going to the Ag Committee, I don't think, compared to the last bill that might have gone there. But I want to just commend Representative Winkler for his work on this project since it all began. It was just a very terrible thing that happened, and you've done a good job of this, and I'm happy you're the one to wrap up this. It's appropriate, and just wanted to say thank you for that.
Any further discussion? Representative Narnas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler. I'm curious, I guess, as to who might qualify for receiving a part of that bridge. For example, I have a group in the community of Dalton that have an annual Threshermen's Reunion, they call it, where they preserve anything old, mostly farm equipment. But they're interested in part of this bridge as part of one of their exhibits, and wondering if they would qualify to apply for a chunk.
Representative
Winkler. Mr. Chair, Representative Nornes, I would direct you to lines 1.10 through 1.17. It says that the commissioner is authorized to distribute free of charge pieces of remnant steel to the Historical Society, to bridge collapse survivors, federal and state agencies related to transportation safety, higher education institutions in the field of engineering, and at the commissioner's discretion, other persons or institutions directly impacted by the bridge collapse. I don't know that the group that you've described necessarily fits under the plain language of those of that list, but I think there is enough discretion built into the bill, and it certainly would be my intention that the commissioner of transportation would have some discretion to review the proposed project and make sure that the steel was being used for appropriate reasons and permit that to happen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, I assume there's a lot of it. And if you want to stretch out a little bit, I have a constituent whose daughter was in that collapse and was severely injured. So if you have to draw some connection locally, there is a connection. I can do that. So thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I should also point out that there is one bridge collapse survivor here in the room, Brent Olson, who has been with this since it began, and they as a group continue to follow all of the events that were engaged in the legislature on this, and continue to be a group of people whose lives were changed forever by this. And so I would hope that the Commissioner of Transportation would have used some good common sense and good judgment in just determining who fits under that list.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, I would hope then as this goes forward and if it does ultimately pass that we find out somehow the process to actually make a formal application.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then Representative Hornstein renews his motion that House File 1451, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And now we have House File 740.
On average.
We want to do this one first? Okay. Staff suggests that we do House File 1792 next, and then we can do the two Fisher bills together. Representative Fisher is going to present the 740. So, Representative Murphy, House File 1792. Or that's going to be Representative Simon. That's right. The agenda shows Representative Murphy, Representative Simon is also on claims with the bill. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will move then that House File 1792 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
Motion is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the annual claims bill. I know a number of you have been around for a while, Representative Davids. Others have served one time or another on the claims committee. For those not aware of it or new to the process, it's a committee of six members, bipartisan and bicameral, a joint committee or commission, I guess it is, that makes decisions on particular claims. It's kind of a unique creature that are submitted to the state that don't fit neatly within other categories like redress in the courts. They sometimes include folks who are incarcerated. They can include property claims against the state that are somewhat unique. And every year, we as a committee, with the aid of the Revisor's Office and Ms. Timmons in particular, this year and the last couple years, is this subcommittee legal counsel, go through each and every claim, and we come to some sort of judgment about whether or not we should pay the claim, and if so, how much. And this year, the bottom line of this, and I'll defer to the revisor, Ms. Timmons, in a second, but the bottom line, as you can see, it's about $20,750, which is less than half of the last one. I think the last one was something like $46,000, if memory serves. So this is a pretty small one this year. There were a handful of claims that we agreed to pay, and I should point out that the four main claims that we agreed to pay out were at the levels suggested by the actual state agencies affected. I think in this case they were all or nearly all from the Department of Corrections, so we're not... No one won the lottery here. We're paying out claims that the department itself acknowledges should be paid. Ms. Timmons, maybe she wants to shed some more light on this.
Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Michelle Timmons, the revisor of statutes, and I also serve as the counsel to the claims committee. And this year there are $5 amounts that comprise the bill. The first dollar amount is $3,701.60, and that's for about 15 claims, very small claims, mostly under $500 for sentence to service medical injuries on behalf of counties that the Department of Corrections already paid, and that's a total amount to reimburse the department. $1,500 is for Terrence Dumont, who was hit in the head by a slog-splitting wedge, and as a result of which he has some chronic headaches, so that's a 2% permanent partial disability rating. We use the workers' compensation schedules as an analogy, and so that's $1,500. The $5,250 for Kent Richard Jones was a situation where at work he was lifting a bank of lockers up onto a sawhorse and hurt his back. So that's a 7% rating, which results in that $5,250 amount. Ms. McCoy is a sentenced to service individual who was shoveling snow for 8 hours. On STS in Washington County, Fortunately, she had no permanent injury, but she did injure her hand and had to have hand surgery. So in this case, we're reimbursing the providers. It was about $6,500 worth of medical expenses, and at the medical assistance rates, it's that $1,794.05 figure. And then the final one is Ms. Mary Jo Muck, who had a pre-existing left rotator cuff injury. She was at Shakopee lifting a bucket of frozen apples and re-injured that left rotator cuff, had to have surgery. And so she actually has a total 18.9% rating. We're attributing it 50% to the prior injury, 50% to the work injury here, and paying 9.45%, which results in that $8,505 figure.
Okay, Representative Holbert.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, was there any discussion, or I don't even know if this is a place where it's going to land, but the state's liability on all these unauthorized access to driver's license records, are these only injury claims that come through the committee, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that's a good question. It did not come up. There were no claims as to that, but my hunch is that the folks who feel aggrieved by that would have a regular claim in court under the Data Practices Act, and therefore would pretty much be ineligible for this. This is those cases that kind of fall through the cracks where there isn't another remedy, and since there is there, at least that would be my advice to them, which is to sue under the Data Practices Act.
Well, Mr. Chair, the big money's coming out of the federal standard at $2,500 a pop. So that's where the money's coming, is that we in the state of Minnesota have fairly weak ability to recover in those instances. But there's been recent articles that have surmised the state may have quite a high level of liability under that federal statute.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg. In the rules of procedure for the claims subcommittee, it says that typically the claims subcommittee will not take jurisdiction over claims where there is a remedy in court. So I think that's the answer for the type of claim that you're asking about.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to commend this. I had to go to this committee. I had to go there once for a constituent. It was awful, man. These are Representative Atkins. This is a tough jury.
Been there.
$1,500 for, like, chronic headaches, really? It's like, wow. Anyway, so they are extremely frugal, shall we say. And I thought I had a really good case, and they just said no. I didn't appreciate it at all, but I think they've got some good. It's a very lean bill. I think members can feel okay supporting it.
Okay, I think there's no further discussion. Representative Simon then renews his motion that House File 1792 be recommended to pass and place in the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We now have House File 740, and on your agenda shows Representative Erickson, but Representative Fisher is going to present the bill this morning. This deals with land transfer. And I think on this one we'll ask DNR. Yeah, I see there. She's coming down because we're talking about land transfers and title, I suppose, and so on. So Representative Fisher, if you just want to tell us a bit about the bill. But Representative Wagenius, do you want to move the bill?
I would like to do that, Mr.
Okay, the motion is made that House File 740 be recommended to pass in place on the general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committees. Very quickly, this is an omnibus lands bill. It's a combination of 12 bills from 9 different representatives. It's bipartisan. The primary purpose of the bill is to authorize the sale or exchange of certain tax forfeited lands, and they're located in the counties of Anoka, Carlton, Cass, Crow Wing, Freeborn, Hubbard, Itasca, Kuchiching, Lake, St. Louis, and Winona counties. The bill also authorizes the DNR to sell or exchange parcels which are located in Crow Wing, Dakota, Fillmore, and Lacaria Peril counties. The bill contains boundary changes for 4 state parks and 1 state forest. It also provides some technical changes to the landowner's bills of rights and provides that the proceeds from the sale of the DNR lands acquired may also be used to pay for expenses incurred by the DNR. Finally, the bill also allows for conveyance of the tax forfeited lands without monetary consideration to school districts and other public education institutions for the purpose of school forests.
Okay, and Ms. Damon, did you have anything to add? You're there available for questions, I think, if there are any. Okay, Representative Davids?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the witness, what is being done in Fillmore County? I didn't have any bills. I just was wondering who was carrying bills in my district.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kathy Lewis, Lands and Minerals, DNR. The property in Fillmore County is from the DNR's land bill. It authorizes the DNR to do a land exchange for land bordering the Rick River. And the reason we sought the legislation is that we're doing an exchange of riparian for non-riparian. So we have to notwithstand the riparian provision, and the exchange will improve access to adjacent state lands.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I had on the agenda, I guess, Ms. Lewis. I said to Damon. Yeah, you did a switch, apparently. Okay. Any further discussion? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewis, I'm just concerned. I've heard from some constituents. I have the Murtaugh family that lost a brother, and now we have a WMA in Goodhue County named after John Murtaugh. And there's a potential private sale or a land exchange with a private property down there. And I understand there was a chance for a while that an amendment might be coming forth before this committee, but I did not see that. And I understand it may come before the floor. And if it does, I just want to make sure that the state doesn't give somebody an opportunity to build a McMansion alongside a WMA and be a big economic winner in this at the expense of the Murtaugh family. And the reason I'm saying this is because there was a large pot of state money used to help buy this WMA, and I think we have to be real careful that we use state money to reward a single private constituent. So I just want to make sure, while we have the DNR an opportunity to testify, that we're not helping out a single private constituent to be able to live on a, like, their own private park overlooking this WMA. And the Murtaugh family is very, very concerned.
Okay, see, now we have, is it two representatives? All right. If you want to identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Tielander. I'm the Wildlife Section Chief for DNR. You can respond to questions on this Murtaugh WMA issue.
Mr. Chair, I don't even know if they need it because it's not even in the bill, but it's my understanding it probably will be on the floor. And I don't know if anybody's come to the Murtaugh family. I know that there's a bill to help this gentleman out, and being a little bit familiar with the project, I want the DNR to know you need to look out for the state interest here, and in the give and take of things, please protect the state's interest. And I don't know if I need to take up any more time with the committee.
It sounds like it's more of a comment.
It was, Mr. Chair. I just want DNR not to think that there's nobody watching out.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara. Yeah, we are working with the landowner to try to address the issue, accommodate the access, but try to keep the WMA whole in the process and not give up any sale of state land when we work through this issue. So we do have the state's issue at heart here, the family of the Murtaugh Memorial WMA, and we'll work to reach a mutually agreeable solution.
Okay, Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at least in the summary I have, I don't show a legislator's bill for the land in Dakota County. I think it's starts on page 15. Do you know where that proposal came from and what it's about?
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, members, that is also from the DNR omnibus bill that was authored by Representative Erickson. And those are two small parcels of land that the DNR is proposing to convey to the local unit of government. One would be for a public park, and the other one would be for public use by the city of Lakeville.
And Mr. Chair, do you know where those are located?
Mr. Chair, members,
Ms. Lewis.
The property is, one of them is in, well, they're both by the city of Lakeville. And one's by Marion Lake, and one is by Orchard Lake.
Does that give you the information you need?
Yeah, I think I'm going to abstain at this point on the bill.
Okay. Any for, let's see, Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lewis, would this affect any individual homeowners? If so, how much the permit would cost? And is this an annual permit or is it a one-time permit?
Mr. Chair, members, could you identify which section you were looking at?
Are we on 683, correct?
No.
No, my fault.
That's the Legislative Water Commission. This is the land transfer. And your agenda shows Representative Erickson's name, but because of the distance, Representative Fisher, the district way up by Canada, he has to, Representative Fisher would carry the bill. Okay, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the DNR, maybe, you know, when the lands bill is put together, if you have land in certain legislators' districts or any legislators' district, maybe they should be notified now. Maybe I was. I don't recall, but just more of a comment, I guess, that if, you know, when I hear Fillmore, my ears perk up, and Representative Holbrook hears Dakota, her ears perk up. So I don't know if you did or not, but if you could just, if there's a land deal in a legislator's district, I'd hope they'd be notified. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any further discussion on House File 740? Seeing that, then Representative Wagenius renews her motion that House File 740 be recommended to pass and place on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Fisher, if you want to stay there, you have the next bill up. And that is House File 683. And Representative Wagenius, would you care to make a motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 683 be recommended and
the general rules. Okay, the motion is before us, and there are two amendments. Would you care to take the two? Okay, the motion is before us, and there are two amendments. Would you care to take the two amendments first?
Yes, please.
Okay, let's see. Representative Wagenius, would you move the A6 amendment?
I will, thank you.
Okay, Representative Wagenius moves the A6 amendment. Any discussion? And if you could explain the amendment.
Very quickly, what this amendment does is about halfway through, it does several different things. Number one, it first of all changes the commission makeup slightly so that it would be a commission of 12 instead of 10, and it would divide it out evenly so that it would be a 3-3 representation between the different parties. Goes into a little bit about the vacancies, how those would be filled, and how it would be first called together. These were some recommendations that I received from some people to try to make this a better bipartisan commission as we go forward. And then the rest of the changes are somewhat substantial in terms of cleaning up and make it simpler. That would start about halfway through on page 2, starting at about line 216. And what it does is it removes everything regarding the permitting of wells and groundwater management areas. That would all be dropped out along with the groundwater sustainability recommendations. That would all be struck. That has a significant impact on the fiscal note also.
The any discussion on Representative Eckhart?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Fisher. However, you failed to say that this language that's leading out of this bill is also included in the Omnibus Environment Finance Bill. And that's the amendment that you had on the floor that we discussed, and it's not like this is going to go away, members. This part of the bill still remains. It's going to be part of Representative Wagenius's Environment Finance Bill, and I'm sure it's going to be coming back from Conference Committee with that in there.
So we have to be upfront and honest, Representative Fisher, that this is not going to go away. It's just going out of this bill. So we're still going to have that issue. And we discussed this on the floor, the amount of money that this is going to cost and what this really covers when we create these groundwater areas. And this is going to be, the DNR now is going to be able to charge a permit fee annually up to $140 for a regular residential well, if you read the statutes. I just want people to be aware of that. Now, it's going to come out of this bill, according to this amendment, but it's not going to go away. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor of the A6 amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Motion carried. Now we have the amendment A7, Representative Wagenius. Okay, Representative Wagenius moves the A7 amendment. This is the appropriation amendment.
I don't think we have it. Mr. Chair, we don't have A7.
I didn't have the bill.
Yeah. I thought it was in the fact that we'll get it.
In the same figures.
What it does, yeah, we can ask the author to share with us what it does, but
thanks.
It's basically $180,000 the first year and $167,000 the second year. Maybe you could explain what that money is for while we're getting copies of the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. What this bill primarily does is allow for staffing, first of all, for the Legislative Water Commission. It would be approximately 1.5 FTE. That is what the main chunk of the cost is going to be. Along with that, there is meeting costs for people who receive per diem and mileage as they're attending the meetings. Also, in the first year, there's some additional money for build-out of office space and equipment for bringing this commission online.
Okay, any discussion while the amendment is being passed out? That's it in a nutshell. Representative Dittmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, my question is, why do we need another legislative commission? Couldn't this, could the Clean Water Council fulfill this function on their own?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dittmer, thank you for asking the question. The problem is that we've got quite a few issues that are facing us as we're dealing with water issues, and they're very complex, and it's something that is very difficult to deal in a short period of time. This deals much more with the policy areas, and we're going to be faced with issues of trying to determine and rewrite many of our water policies. There's going to be some major policy coming through for next year to establish guidelines for how we're going to deal with properties and water issues within water management areas as they're discussed. This is something that I know that DNR is going to be coming out with. There's going to be a lot of work and debate that's going to occur in these type of things. And because of the amount of time, it's very difficult for a commission that's dealing with the clean water, where they're dealing more with the water, with the monetary issues and programs, versus a commission where we're dealing primarily with policy.
Yeah. You represent Hackbarth?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to that point.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now, what outcomes are we do we expect out of the commission? What do we expect out of this? If it
I think the outcomes that we're expecting, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative, the outcomes that we're dealing with is making sure that we've got good outcomes. The problem that we have right now, from having talked to a number of people and taking a look at a number of studies that have come out over the last couple of years dealing with our water issues, is right now we're in a reactive mode, and as a result, we're not getting good water policy. And if we're getting good water policy right now, I'm being told it's more by chance than by design. What this allows us to do is go into a proactive type recommendation, dealing with these issues in a very thoughtful way before we get to session, being able to spend the time on it. Many of these issues require a lot of education. I know that when I was first starting on this, I was attending a lot of Representative Wagenius' committee meetings on this, where we were spending many hours just to get brought up to speed. So these are very complex issues. Right here, I've got a number of different studies that have been done where there are many recommendations that require legislative input and legislative discussion. And some of these things are dealing with how land permitting may eventually happen in the process in the future, may involve more dealing around water pricing, and also has a big impact between what rural and outstate areas are. And because the way you want to write things for the A water shortage area may be different than how you want it to apply in an area where we've got surplus water. It requires a lot of very thoughtful and very diligent work to be able to have the thorough discussions needed to make sure we're getting great policy. Right now, the example I would use, we try to do a simple water conservation pricing in water management areas. That's what this bill started out as. And because of the concerns that were brought up and the difficulty in getting some information out, that ended up being dropped totally out, so I could spend more time on that between sessions talking to different people to bring it back. So what it's trying to do is give us the chance to be able to do our homework properly before we get to session.
Okay, Representative Hackburn?
I'll pass to after this amendment.
Okay, Representative McNamara?
You know what? Mine's to the bill.
Okay. Yes, that's a good reminder. This is the amendment that's right before us. Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're on the A7 amendment to pay for.
That's right.
The appropriation. Well, this is probably more towards the A6 amendment, but everything that you stated about a need for a special commission could be accomplished by interim hearings of Representative Wagenius's committee, so I don't know why we're spending $180,000 when there could be interim hearings and the committee could develop expertise and work towards resolution.
Okay, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. That's a good question. We spent a lot of time in our committee this year just kind of getting up to speed on this issue. And frankly, we didn't spend enough time. I mean, no, we could have spent more time and spent more time wisely. And doing interim hearings, perfectly fine with me. The Senate has done nothing. Zero. So for the House and Senate to get on the same page, we could probably do more of. And it would help us all in making good decisions.
Mr. Chair, I think, you know, you're looking at thousands of dollars for infrastructure, 1.5 staff members, you know, continuing costs in the future. It may be the right approach, but I think that ultimately the legislature is going to be the one to make the decision, and maybe a conversation with the Senate and some joint hearings in the interim might be a much more frugal approach to the problem. That's just a comment.
Okay, we have Representative McNamara.
No, it was to the bill.
Oh, it was to the bill. Okay, then Representative Anderson. That's to the bill as well. Okay, any further discussion on the amendment for the appropriation? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Now we have the bill before us as amended. Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, the bill is amended now. Members, we spent hundreds of millions of dollars. We appropriate hundreds of millions of dollars every legislative session to look at water. And the DNR is doing it. Bowser's doing it. Ag is doing it. The Department of Health is doing it. The Metropolitan Council is doing it. All these different soil and water conservation districts are doing it. We're spending a lot of money, taxpayer dollars, to look at water. And if we are failing in any area, such as Representative Fisher suggests, it's a failure on this legislature or the people that are in the administration that are looking over this within these different departments. If something is wrong, that's where it has to be fixed. Building another layer of bureaucracy and having another commission, Representative Fisher, with only legislators on it, and you can't even imagine how many times I've been here, Representative Fisher, where I've heard from the DFL that we need to put citizens on these commissions and councils, etc., and we don't have that on this. We just put additional legislators on there. This is the wrong approach. We need to take this by the bull by the horns and fix it legislatively or through the administration to tell people, give us this information or get us this information or work to fix this problem. This is not the answer. Please vote no on this bill.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, I think it's really too bad we're going here. Just to remind you, I think at least six environment policy committees got canceled in the last session because we didn't have anything to do. We have all kinds of opportunity for the entire environment policy committee, which is where this should be discussed, this business done. This is not needed. It's unnecessary. It's duplicative. And it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars at a time when we really need the money. I think I will remind you what you actually said. This is about land use and water pricing. I will tell you that is very scary, very, very, very scary, that we are now going to give the DNR the authority to tell somebody they can't put a well on where they want to build their home. And I do that in the context, I just heard from another constituent last night at a fundraiser dinner I was at. He said, Denny, do you know that since 1975, the Dakota County Soil and Water Conservation District has monitored our irrigation well? Today, it has 1 foot water, more water in it than 1975. I said, John, I can't believe that. So they're doing the same thing to you? So what are you talking about, Denny? I said, you know, Gene Smolich told me the same thing a few weeks ago, and it was the first time I heard about it. He says they do it everywhere. So all this talk about we're not monitoring the wells, I think you need to have the state talk to the county and figure out what's going on here. Because the county's got a bunch of data already on the monitoring in Dakota County, and I keep hearing over and over how we're taking all the water away from Dakota County and we don't know the monitoring. But every time I go to the farmers, the guys actually living out there doing their thing and know what's going on, say, it's already being monitored. And he actually told me, he said, we have a foot more than 1975. And he said, that's one of the first irrigators that got put in around here, Denny, and it's got a foot more today than before. So I think we should know more about what we're doing here in these bills. You got to be careful about giving the Department of Natural Resources the authority to start stopping of building homes, especially when we're not already using the data we already have. We don't need to be giving these agencies more authority. We don't need to be creating more commissions when we're getting already our committees being canceled. So please reconsider this, and we should get it out of the omnibus bill. And this even makes it worse when you gave it the money.
Representative Anderson.
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if what is the status of this bill, Representative Fisher, in the Senate? Where is it at right now?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson. The status of the bill is that there is an author on the other side. The route of this would be that if passed off our floor, I have talked to Senator Tomassoni that they would engage it into the omnibus, for the conference committee on environmental, the environmental bill.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, you're saying that the bill hasn't moved over in the Senate?
That is correct.
Okay. And so Representative Wagenius earlier mentioned that she hasn't had any movement on the Senate side. If we create this commission and the senators don't show up, then what's your plan B, Representative Fisher?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, from my understanding, there will be senators on that side who would be interested that would show up.
Okay. Representative Fisher, that's only if they are appointed to the committee, and that's actually determined by Senate Majority Leader Bach, and the bill hasn't moved over in the Senate. I think I kind of see the signal here. Oh, that's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fisher, any concluding comments?
Yes, just very quickly, what we're doing is we're just building off of our recommendations of the previous reports we had. The Minnesota Water Sustainability Framework had recommended that this is one of the processes that we need to go through in reestablishing this commission to provide a forum for considering implications of proposed legislation addressing water sustainability. And I think from some of the arguments that we're starting to hear around the table here, there are some great concerns that are going to come up as the water issues come forward. If we don't have the right quorum to be able to do this properly, we're not going to end up with good legislation, and that's why I'm asking for a yes vote.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Wagenius, there is a motion that House File 683, first engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Yeah, I forgot.
We are going to, by way of announcements, and we'll get the agenda out shortly, but Ways and Means will be meeting on Thursday. Do we have a time set yet? Probably about 8 o'clock, okay? Good early start on Thursday. And then Representative Hackbarth had a question the other day when we were dealing with the pension bill about public safety. I don't know if the gentleman had a chance to talk with you, but a fellow by the name of Neil Melton came here at the beginning of the meeting. He heads the post board, and he said that there will be an adequate number of public safety people trained for any vacancies that would be coming about as a result of the retirement bills. And I told him to contact you, but I thought I'd make the announcement, being that others may have been interested. Okay, with that, meeting adjourned.